Our next speaker is going to deal with the certification dance. John? I just had the pleasure of meeting John, so, and we're talking about some of his activities, and he's got a mind-boggling number of jurisdictions that he's dealing with in the housing process. So I think he's eminently qualified to lead us through the certification dance.
First thing I'd like to say is I am really impressed by the brain power that's been assembled here today. I do a lot of housing element work myself, but I'm also a student of this process, and so I'm looking forward. I've enjoyed listening to the other speakers, and I'm looking forward to listening to the speakers that come after me this afternoon. I started my career working as a local government planner for about 20 years before I went into consulting, and I'll tell you, the consulting business is very interesting. I mean, my work is very glamorous and rewarding, I can tell you, as a consultant. For example, some of the things that I have the pleasure of is explaining to city councils who have a maximum density in their town of 6 units per acre that's just not going to cut it for purposes of the housing element. I have the pleasure of explaining to planning directors why the original schedule in our contract said that we would get certification of this document within a year of starting, and here it is 3 years later, and we're on our fourth round of review with the state HCD. and why the budget that was in there for making revisions to the housing element was gone a long time ago. So anyhow, this when I heard that Paul's title was prescription for pain-free housing elements, I first thought, well, maybe I should be living with pain, but I thought, no, that, I don't want to go there. Anyhow, much of what I have to say has already been covered by others. I have maybe a little bit different take on some of it than the others do, but you know, the one of those sayings in presentations is you tell them what you're going to tell them, and then you told them what you told them. So others have covered some of this stuff, and by the end of the day, those of you who are not all that familiar with the housing element process before you walked in the door today, I bet you will walk out with a much better understanding. I want to cover three different general topics in my remarks. First, just a quick recap of Senate Bill 375 that's already been talked about by several of the other speakers. Then the meat of my presentation has to do with the critical link between housing elements and 375, which is the site's inventory. And Paul spent a lot of time talking about what HCD looks for in the site's inventory. So I'm going to give a little bit of my perspective and experience on that too. And then closing with some challenges and opportunities going forward to this next housing element cycle. These various requirements, I think, have been covered by others. The purpose of 375, reduce greenhouse gases, trip reduction, more compact development, the alignment of the RENA with the Regional Transportation Plan, Sustainable Community Strategy, incorporating the RENA into the housing elements and complying with those growth needs. The most important difference, I think, is the greater reliance that we're going to see on infill and redevelopment sites as compared to previous RENA cycles. Oh, how'd that thing about the flowers in Kathy's office? I don't know where that came from. No. Okay. And let me say this again. Greater reliance on redevelopment and infill sites. That's what it's all about. This is just to show Paul that I did, in fact, use the Building Blocks website, which is very useful, and I appreciate that HCD has done that. These are the different categories of sites that make up a site's inventory. Now, in the past, as you might expect, the vast majority of sites that were used to demonstrate conformance or sufficient capacity to accommodate the RENA has been in that first category of sites, the vacant residentially zoned sites. You might think of greenfield sites. Those are the easiest to demonstrate. And as we move down this scale, it gets progressively more difficult to get through that gauntlet of the various review criteria that Paul talked about. And that is where we're headed with this next round of housing elements. So the key question becomes, what is a suitable site? Again, others have already talked about this. Paul spent some good time talking about it. Is the zoning correct? Is the density correct? Is it a sufficient size to accommodate a realistic opportunity for a housing project? Is it vacant or is it underutilized? Actually, I think that last one, Paul argued for that, but it was deleted in the last version of SB 375 before it was adopted. Okay. When we, Paul's an avid fisherman, and you know, people who have worked with him know that. the criteria that are used in first preparing the land inventory and then the review of that with State HCD include a wide variety of things, and others have talked about those various criteria. What is challenging is that they're really, in most cases, there really aren't any clear objective standards for those criteria and how they translate into a suitable site. So there are various bits of information that can be offered up as evidence that a parcel is suitable. But when it comes right down to it, there's a lot of subjective decision making that goes into this process. And I can tell you, the other consultants in the room can tell you, Paul can tell you, that this is not an exact science. And so therein lies the challenge. We really have two different categories of development that we're talking about in this realm of underutilized and infill. One area is a purely residential project that happens to be infill, or it happens to be on a redevelopment project. But then there's also mixed use, and mixed use brings in other complexities. For example, is residential a permitted use in the mixed use zoning, or is it required? If it's required, what is the minimum level? If you look at specific plans or mixed use zones, you will see that some of them may have maximum floor area ratios for commercial development, and then they may have statements that residential is optional as long as it meets certain development standards. Other ordinances, I'm working with one jurisdiction now, it's preparing a specific plan that actually has a minimum residential component of a mixed-use project based on the floor area ratio of that project. And so in situations like that, when we prepare the housing element and we can rely on a minimum level of residential development in a mixed-use project, that makes it much easier to convince our friends at HCD that that is a viable assumption in terms of development. So for those of you that have mixed use or are looking at mixed use ordinances or preparing specific plans and so forth, I would definitely give that some thought as to how residential is treated in those mixed use ordinances, whether it's optional, mandatory, at what ratio, and that sort of thing. Are there incentives for residential? One of my other jurisdiction clients allows mixed use development in their commercial zone. So it's this is in an older urban area where they have miles and miles of commercial along arterials, and they allow residential above the commercial. So there's an incentive there. If the developer wants to do a straight commercial project, they can get X number of square feet of commercial. But if they do a mixed use project, they can get that X commercial plus a couple levels of residential above. So that creates some incentives, an economic incentive that is persuasive in arguing that those sites are a legitimate part of the land inventory. Yeah, the only difference between these two slides is at the red at the top there. SB 375 is more of this analysis which is a much trickier topic than when you simply are adding up vacant residential land. Okay, I wanted to mention some previous good work that has been done, that you know, we stand on the shoulders of those that went before us. 5 or 6 years ago, UC Berkeley did a groundbreaking study estimating the infill capacity of the entire state of California. And that's an interesting read if you have the time. They used as their primary data source the assessor's parcel information from each county. And as a baseline screening mechanism, they used this notion of the ratio of the value of improvements on the property to the land value. And I actually have my greater than less than symbols reversed on this, I realized as I was looking at it this morning. But the baseline assumption that they used in this study is that if the ratio of improvement value to land value is less than 1.0, then that was considered, at least for the preliminary cut, that was considered a potential infill reuse site for commercial or for multifamily use. And for single family use, they used a ratio of 0.5. And the rationale there is that you have a lot of, you know, very good quality, stable single family homes where the land value is quite high relative to the structure, and so it's not likely to turn over and recycle through redevelopment. Then this morning, we heard Marty's presentation about the Ready system, and this really intrigues me. I'm looking forward to seeing how this information is going to play out in the next housing element cycle. I think it has great potential to be one tool that we use in putting together our land inventories. I do have some concerns about it that I want to talk about as I transition here into the challenges and opportunities. One of the challenges, you know, there's a fellow by the name of Stephen Covey who wrote a book years ago called The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And one of those habits is begin with the end in mind. So I think that behooves us all, not only as planners, but as we go through this RENA process, as we go through housing elements, we think ahead as to what the outcome is that we would like to be at a couple of years from now. And that is very true about this upcoming RENA process. So I know a couple of weeks ago, Susan and I had a conversation about the upcoming RENA process and my observations on it. And one of the things that I said to her is, if there was one bit of information that I could have that was the most important to me if I were in your shoes, is to know now what the land inventory capacity is of each jurisdiction using housing element criteria. Because the housing element criteria are a little bit different than other measures of land inventory. For example, one of the things that occurred to me as I was listening to Marty's presentation this morning is that their concept of market readiness that they used in putting together the time horizon for the various sites is based on planning entitlements and applications and the status of a project in the process. But I think Paul will support me when I tell you that when HCD looks at a site and the income category that that site should be placed in, once a project has been submitted for review and approved, then the density is no longer a proxy for the affordability on that project. So if the project is 40 or 50 units per acre, let's say, then HCD will say, the density is no longer the relevant bit of information. What's relevant is what is the anticipated affordability level of those units. I know this was an issue for a large city up in Orange County. I didn't work with them, but a large city in Orange County had a very, very extensive redevelopment project area that called for a lot of mid-rise and high-rise housing at greater than 30 units per acre. But when they submitted their housing element, none of it had been built yet, but it was entitled. And so when HCD looked at that jurisdiction, they said, well, okay, these are entitled projects, what affordability level do you expect those units to be? None of them had affordability covenants, and they were expected to be upper income condos and apartments. So none of those sites counted for the low income inventory, despite the fact that they were greater than 30 units per acre. So what that means is that as we're preparing our land inventories and as we're comparing them to the need that's expressed in ARENA, we have to look at it through the lens of what is considered an affordable housing site based on housing element criteria. So that's one of the things that I look to see how it's going to play out in this next ARENA cycle, and particularly how the READY system relates to the ARENA cycle. The bottom line for me is, as we go forward in this new era of SB 375, we have a number of competing public policy objectives. We've got global warming, climate change, greenhouse gas, all of those objectives, which are legitimate. Those are legitimate public purposes. Affordable housing, suitable housing for all income segments, another legitimate public policy objective. Environmental protection, we've got all of these things. As planners, you all know that. You know that you, as planners and decision makers, have to juggle those competing objectives all the time. So one of the things that I personally plan to be looking into over the next year, in fact, I'm working with a grad student at UC Irvine right now on a professional report on the issue of mixed use and how current state-of-the-art and standards in mixed-use development relate to these other public policy objectives of affordable housing, transit-oriented development, greenhouse gas, and so forth. Another thing that I think Paul and others have alluded to is the limited funding for affordable housing, such as low-income housing tax credits, the multifamily housing bond program, and so forth. Those programs have criteria that they use in order to evaluate which projects should get funding. And so I'm curious about how those criteria are pushing development, what effect those criteria are having on the development process, and how those forces relate to these other public policy objectives. So at this point, I have more questions than I do answers on things like that, but I expect to be looking into it over the next year or so. Some of you may have seen an article that was in the current issue of the San Diego chapter APA newsletter. My colleague and friend Greg Kohenar and I put that article together, and that I view that as kind of the first step of the process, the thought process that I know I've personally been going through over the next couple of years. So I think I will stop there, because I'm curious to hear what the other speakers had to say. I just had to put this picture in here. It has absolutely nothing to do with my presentation, but at conferences like this, the architects and the developers, they're the rock stars. They've got all the pretty pictures, and us policy planners, we don't have much. So anyway, there's my my contribution to the aesthetics. Thank you.
A demonstration that low-income housing